reveal to him that he sings it as he sings it. And, it, you know, that, that's why. That's why people are, go through so much in Bruce Springsteen, because it's real to him. And that's all a performer does, you know, before. It's not an intellectual or even an artist. But he's a person who expresses.
Yeah. It's also sure real. But I'm sure that's true, you know, for you to a great extent.
Obviously, what I'm saying is that.
Yeah, but
you know, I find myself in interviews, and I'm sure it's the case as the band, in interviews, where I take on a role that is not true. I'm not being true to what I do, or the band is not being true to what it does. Where we either blow it out of proportion, the importance of the role, or else, you know, what we do is very inarticulate. You know, I'm an extremely inarticulate person. That, it's the cliche, that's really why I write songs. And the songs, indeed, are songs of inarticulation. I try to stand up, but I can't find my feet. I try to sing the song. Everything, I mean, in fact, given 6 minutes of this new record devoted to inarticulation, Elvis Presley in America, it's a mumble. It is a mumble, and it's there as a record of what we're talking about. And the Elvis Presley reference, which is, you know, meant as a joke, Elvis Presley in America is like everything and nothing, was the reference was of a man who was inarticulate. You know, I have a record at home, 1957 recording of an Elvis Presley press conference, where it's described on the back of this bootleg. This setup where the people were in a circle around Elvis Presley, and Colonel Tom Park was behind the people, and he signaled to Elvis Presley whenever he felt he should avoid a question. You hear this rebel of the generation, his answer to what do you think of classical music, Elvis, signal from Tom Parker, and Elvis goes, I just don't know. I'm not knocking it. I just don't understand it. And why didn't he say, it's not nothing to do with what I'm doing, or it's not real to the people that we live in Memphis, or... He didn't say anything, he just avoided it. Colonel Tom Parker turned him into a buffoon. And I felt he had a chip on his shoulder all his life about feeling inarticulate, about the fact he couldn't express himself, yes, sir. No man. You know all the answers to the question. And that book by Albert Goldman, which, you know, there it was, you know, because he didn't express himself the way the middle class want people to express him, he therefore was an idiot. But he was a true genius. He expressed himself in the way he held the microphone. He expressed himself in the way he sung through the microphone. The way he moved his hips, that's expression. And yet performers who express themselves instinctively through that are expected to, with their words, be able to wrap it up in what they do. And I'm guilty of trying. That's the real pain in the ass. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to realize I should stop.
The whole thing only ever becomes relevant when it's seen in the context that it's meant to be seen. Because that's when you believe it, and that's when it is real. And you can do something with it. There's no point in trying to fake it. And it's not in the context when it's not right. You know, you can't think of it as a constant thing.
I see what you're saying, but the thing is that rock goes out to people, and it exists in a context, and people are not content just to go along to a show or just listen to a record and share in the emotion, which is what it's all about. I agree with you entirely.
Yeah, you know why that
take
is.
Take it out of that.
Because, I mean, there has been a very definite kind of marketplace being artificially produced whereby you sell colour magazines and photographs every week. I mean, so people in those positions where people are interested in finding out about them have to be personalities at the same time.
Yeah.
So once that happens, the whole music business has become corrupted anyway, because you're then saying, well, the emotional, the music important thing, that, you know, we can get away with that. You're not asserting that as the basic criteria for you being up there on that stage. You're admitting to all the hype and encouraging it.
I think that all began perhaps not so much with Elvis, because he was so cloudy, he was so sort of being enclosed by such a war of security, but by the Fab Four, far more, I think, as well as anything to do. But I find, I mean, there's also, I'm not a great Julie Birchall fan, but also, like, she begins in Time Out column, and the piece is, I don't think, awfully good. You can sell me, I'm sure the world won't mind if you take that piece. Okay. But she talks about, you know, politics and bands and why the two shouldn't mix in interviews with nowhere else, you know. And that's what I find, you know, the most embarrassing thing, to actually read interviews in NME when bands try and articulate about politics, and, you know, they are. There's no reason why their views would be more interesting than
exactly. And in fact, in most cases, they're invariably less interesting and extremely dull and ill-informed, you know, quite often.
Yeah.
However, the reason those opinions are usually expressed is because, however dull and uninteresting they may be, there is a direct gamble that the majority of people listening to it will absorb that and feel good that it agrees with the way they think about it. Because most people have a very, I think, very individual idea of politics. I think we're all pretty blinkered. We don't really want to ask too many questions. But we'll sort of settle for what's safe as much as we can handle it, because if one ever did really sort of consider politics as sort of be all and end all and what it should be and where it should be going, you'd actually be taking on a crusade pretty much like that of Jesus Christ. You know, you'd have to start right from the beginning and redefine the whole thing, and probably in the process become corrupted yourself.
But it's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because music does attach itself to other aspects of people's lives.
Well, I think
and I accept what you said before to some extent, but I'm not entirely satisfied that it's just an expression of kind of hype and the media that these industries exist.
No, I'm not writing it off in that way. Certainly not. But what I am saying is that the original reason for rock and roll inevitably is no longer protected. You know, it's been made into so many other things that constitute entertainment as opposed to rock and roll. Rock and roll is a very special and small area of music. And you know, what Culture Club are doing, or Duran Duran or something, it's all praiseworthy in its own way. But as far as I'm concerned, it's nothing to do with what rock and roll is about. It has aspects of it. Certainly, it's in there, but it's not the prime.
But do you feel thing. That the fact that, you know, like, obviously, you haven't done, you mean you as the band haven't done many interviews, and you haven't done the supermarket opening type, you know, they haven't signed records in. Do you feel that is deliberately working against that sort of hype? I mean, would that, if you did that, would that turn you into a Duran Duran? to that in respect of what you're using?
I think it would certainly, at the end of the day, cheapen what we do. Unless I felt, I suppose, that we could do it and do it with our integrity intact. But I think if we don't feel good about it and don't rise to the occasion naturally, then it must be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
Because that's the basis on which we decide to do most things, whether we feel right about it. Not necessarily because you want to do it or you don't want to do it, but if you feel just right and say, okay, I'm prepared to handle something that's difficult because I feel right about it and I think I can get through. But if that experimentation never comes, I think we're better off not doing it. And I think more so nowadays, when we can, we're right most of the time if we say no 90% of the time, because I think we're now in that position where any time when we do something, it by its very nature has to justify itself by being important, and you can't do that if you're not feeling right about talking to someone. You'll only talk nonsense, and it won't be worthwhile.
I mean, do you feel that you've got a following who, obviously, I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that what you put out, but that also admire your integrity in not doing smash hits every other week?
I don't know whether that's something that somebody would say to justify why we were good.
Yeah.
I think it's an aspect, I think it's a colouring that people notice self-consciously, and it shapes the way they think about the band. But I don't think it's by any means a broad, blatant stroke that people go, oh, you too, that's the band that doesn't do smash hits, you know.
I think it's subtler than that.
Is this something that's evolved rather than was, and is now part of you, rather than something that was part of you when you started out?
Well, yeah, it's something that we're comfortable with. I mean, talking about it in this depth is implying that we've thought about it a lot and taken it very seriously. I think it's almost a head adjustment. If you accept that we're not an English band, right, and we don't live in England, we don't socialise in England, and okay, maybe we're only an hour away, but as far as people are concerned, you know, we might as well be an American band. And you look at an American band and how often they may do interviews, and it's really not that often. And I think that's all we're doing. We're just doing it when it's right. Whereas in England, there's almost this treadmill of doing interviews on a fairly regular basis.
Has the fact that you have been a Dublin band helped you?
Immensely. I mean, I think very definitely in the early days, it was the thing that gave us the drive to get out there and basically take on the alien world. I mean, we knew Dublin quite well and could obviously get gigs and all that kind of thing. And the next hassle was that, you know, that obviously wasn't good enough for us. We wanted to take it further. So, in terms of, say, England and the rest of the world and all that sort of thing, I think we could sit back and just view, you know, what would the important things do, what were the worthwhile things to do, and just fight for them. and go out and get them. And then, at the same time, I think in any band's career, that there's obviously a period where they do become fairly alienated and are in danger of going quite loopy. Because once you get into that treadmill, your head spins. Particularly if you come from an environment like Dublin, where you don't even know what it's like to catch a tube, for instance. You know, that experience comes to you when you're 18 and you're playing in the Marquee. I think you can really lose your bearings. And living in Dublin was very much the bolt hole of we could go out and experience these things, and then we come back here. And Dublin is such a real place to live in. It brings you down to earth with a real bump. But increasingly, as the rest of the world was becoming more and more exciting, you wanted to come down with a bump when you got back, because you then returned to what you were like, because that was you living in your own environment and facing yourself in the mirror every day. I think on tour, you know, you're wearing a different hat, for instance. You're out there, you're doing concerts, you are a public figure, and your responsibility is to the show and to the people who have paid money, and you're giving out all the time. Mm-hmm. You're exuding.
But I mean, ultimately, the songs that you're playing, even if you're playing in Perth, those are the songs you made that year. Right? Mm. So in a sense, you are keeping that integrity up.
Well, I think being on stage is one of the easiest parts of being on tour. Because that's your environment. Nobody else goes there.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
yours.
Yeah.
I think it's all the other unnatural elements around it that cause the problems. And that's where you do need a safe house every so often.
Yeah.
What are the qualities, you think, that all... It may be easier for you to say what are the things that are absent in some people that causes them to go loopy and, as you say, into kind of really lose contact with just what your everyday run-of-the-mill life is like?
I don't really know. I think it perhaps comes down to a sort of desperation and perhaps ultimately a lack of honesty. But I don't think that undermines what those people do. We've all found in the course of the band that it has been worthwhile preserving certain things, that although it makes no sense to do that in a sensible way, they're worthwhile things to do for our own personal lives, and you know, those are kind of, they're becoming sacred areas. For instance, in Australia and Japan, we found, because the level of the way we were perceived there was encouraging an awful lot of what we sort of laughingly call Beatlemania, which is arriving in towns and there's people at the airports or the train stations and at the hotel, and it does actually take away your privacy in an alarming way. I never thought it would, but you actually do get to a point where you value your time absolutely on your own, because you can do what you like. You can fart and nobody will hear you. And that's marvellous, to just take it all off and put it down and be on your own. And because of the pressure of those things, I could say to myself, hang on, I can see why big bands have separate emos to gigs. Because quite honestly, that is the only time that those people are on their own. And it's not because they don't like each other, they like the rest of the band and they see the other band a lot, but they want their own space. And I thought, so that's what they do. That's not what I want to do.
and it's not what this band wants to do, to actually get to a point where it's snatching 10 minutes on its own in a limo.
Yeah.
So we have to decide how we're going to deal with that, and we will deal with it. Because it's not worth sacrificing the way we feel.
Is this something that you've really become more and more aware of in the last year or so?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what sort of problems have you had to sort of face in that sense? I mean, how have you felt it sort of creeping up on you gradually? Or
well, I think, yeah, the intensity and the level at which we've been working recently. The album was very tough. I mean, it's a lot of hard work and you know, obviously the musical rows occur. And we just kind of said at the end of it, okay, it's a great record, but, you know, we know each other well enough and respect each other well enough that we never actually want to make a record again and strain the relationship to that extent. So I think that's what it is. We have to, you know, the old quote of this band was formed on a friendship, which certainly was true, but we have to remember that that's what it should remain as. It should never be that important that that friendship gets pushed into the background. That is the most important thing, and you two's humanity is the important thing. If we happen to make great music, fine, and the music, I believe, is not great because it's the penultimate form of expression. It's the way in which it comes across, yeah, which is the important thing.
Yeah. But is that also because your success has been built up very gradually, and you've had time to think about things? You know, like it wasn't.
Well,
like
we've had time to grow into the new shoes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But also, I mean, you know, your own personal friendship must have been bonded even more because you've worked in finally beginning to grow and all of that.
Yeah, but that, yes, but I mean that wasn't really a personal friendship. That was, in a way, a professional friendship that we did because we were working, I mean, pretty much flat out for 6 years. And this year, when things did slow down a bit, and we caught up with ourselves, I mean, it sounds very dramatic, but to put it in context, from 16 years old, we were, okay, living at home in school. In the space of the last 6 years, we're young men, okay, and some of the band are married, and we have houses and we live on our own. And we've gone from living at home, working hard in a band 24 hours a day, to something else, and there's been no bit in between linking it. So we've had to grow back into our personal lives. And that's something that we've decided that, you know, that is we should get back to being a band and that friendship and feeling right about it. And it's not something that can be contrived. It's knowing how we should work for the next couple of years.
Do you still hold on to all your ambitions about?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure inevitably one becomes cynical, but I think those basic ambitions and motivations are still very, very much there. I don't think that's gone at all. I don't really think it ever will. I mean, there is an ultimate kind of naivety to it that I think we know, but it is part of our personality at this stage.
Yeah. But do you think that's necessary, really, that naivety, in a sense, to...
I think it's necessary to what we do. I don't think it's necessary to what everybody else does.
Yeah. Because that's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of... it's the one thing that's always difficult to hold on to, that when you see that you've begun to achieve the things you set out about achieving 5 or 6 years ago and seemed impossible then, and that's the kind of traditional hurdle which people don't get over, It's the thing about a band's longevity, whether they're going to be around for a long time.
Mm.
It's like a series of obstacles that they go through. And it's just interesting what these personal qualities are required to get through all that. Paul said that he reckoned you could still be making rock and roll records when you were all...
when you were in a wheelchair.
Going around in your wheelchair.
You probably hope so. Because you have the retirement home. Paul believes in the rock and roll band as a real thing. You know, he believes he's into groups like the Stones, he's into groups like the Beatles, he believes in the group. And Paul sees us as that. And,
that may happen. I hope we never work towards it.
No, I mean, to be honest, I don't think that's, too far.
Yeah,
I think it's essential to think more or less day to day.
I mean, seriously, our next LP, we must just, working on that, that's what preoccupies us at the moment.
Mm.
You know, the idea of being around, I personally dislike old memories on the stage. In the blues context, I can understand it, that's, for that reason I can sort of...
Well, I think that you have to assume that that if that did happen to us, it would be right and relevant. You know, I don't think we'd be. But that's the nation.
But you don't know.
I think we'd make.
But
that
you don't know. You just do it. But then you too late.
Pete Townsend, so much time for him.
And there's a problem, isn't there? Because you, rock and roll is so much about adolescent sexuality, so involved with that, that there does come, it does seem that there seems almost vague, it's almost obscene seeing.
Because I mean, I, for instance, as an adolescent, found Bill Haley and the Comets obscene. I couldn't.
But he was almost obscene from day one. He was so old when he met Anna Elvis.
Oh, right,
Because he was, I don't know how old he was when he went around the world, but
I just couldn't, as a 13 year old, couldn't, one of the things that you probably noticed or took out of the documentary was, I think it's in there, when Eno has talked a lot about this. The fact that this is a group, and that he's never worked with a group before. And there are not many groups. In our era, there are not many groups. You could count them on one hand. The era of the group ended a long time ago. People, the quartet was still being around, but not the group.
Because, well, Roxy Music themselves were, I remember seeing them.
An ensemble, really.
Yeah, they were completely. I remember seeing them in very early days, and they were just, there were these two, Eno and Ferry, these two colliding egos on stage.
Yeah.
And it was obvious that they just couldn't stay like that, because they weren't a band.
Yeah. And indeed, in this group, there are four colliding egos, but it's a band ego that dominates, not individual members. And I remember, when Brian first arrived at the castle, Slane Castle, he came to me and he spent some time with me, it's not him. Spent some time with Ed, it's not him. And he realized that none of us would be the one he could go through. He had previously worked with ensembles, you take Talking Heads, that it was four. And he really, it made mean, that is what is at the root of this group is the spirit in which the music is made. That was what interested him about our music. Well, that's why I bring it down to that.
How has that changed in the last 5 years,
Well, the last year, if you want to put it like that, there's been more of a temptation as for the individuals to be isolated from the room. You know, as you fall in love, you fall away. Go home with people, other people.
You can't sort of satisfy by a given amount of work a day, you know.
Yeah.
There are more sacred things to the group, that have to be acknowledged, and we have to start making more decisions perhaps on that basis than we may have done in the past. And ultimately, that's what we're here for, you know. That's the whole base on what we've ever done is by us believing in it and wanting to do it. And if you erode that, and that's not by being sloppy musicians, it's a lot deeper than that.
Yeah.
If you erode that feeling of worthwhile and doing something that you believe in, well, then you have nothing.
You obviously have an immense control over your output, in the sense that you know, all the songs are yours, all the singles choices are yours. You do all the artwork, you just give either the finished product, and this is it, we want it out there, bye-bye, right? Do you ever feel that you did not have that full control? Do you ever feel that there was someone looking after your artwork?
Never. Not from day one.
I mean, that kind of...
In the sense that would be a view less to think about.
Oh, it would, and... in these 2 years, you hope that, you know, you can find collaborators who will take a bit more away, but who will still retain... who will understand what you're doing. Hence, working with Anton Corbin, he understands the group, so you can... You know, we have a... guy, Steve Alvin, Dublin, Meert in Wimbledon. Wimbledon is very important to the understanding of the groups.